You just don't need him so much. Ain't war hell?
All right, y'all, welcome to the show. Sorry I had to put you off a sec because I was on the phone. Here's another one.
He says, taste the soup. He says, there's something wrong with the soup. Is the soup too hot? He says, will you taste the soup? It's wrong. Is the soup too cold? Will you just taste the soup? All right, I'll taste the soup. Where's the spoon? Aha. Aha.
All right, I'm sorry. That's my favorite soundbite of anything ever, I guess. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy stuff is pretty much the name of the game here. Today on the show, this is why I was on the phone just now. Today on the show, we will have Mr. Eric Margolies on the show. And he is going to be speaking with us about the war in Afghanistan. I am too, here in just one sec, if you bear with me. Today's show, Eric Margolies, that's how you spell it, like Margolies, and Cora Courier. You don't spell it like Courier. It's different. And she, oh boy, is she going to be on about a big story today. You guys see the news this morning? Did you see the news? All right, hang on. So I got to paste that there, and I got to select that there, and get that there, and then I got to copy and paste this thing here. So yeah, man, you know, I got to blog and tweet and tell the people that there's a show today with guests on it. Yeah, it's the Liberty Radio Network. I'm here, live on the weekdays from noon to 2 Eastern time, 11 to 1 Texas time. My website is scotthorton.org. You can find the goddamn chat room there too. If you want to hang out with the boys during the live show. It's scotthorton.org/chat. Just a fake name and a captcha, and you're in there. And, or if you do, you know, XChat or ChatZilla or Pigeon or any of them external chatting type applications, then it's a IRC free node chat, hashtag Scott Horton Show. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. But all you need is your plain old browser window. Even Internet Explorer would work. Yeah, today on the show, like I say, Margolies and, Courier. So, first of all, Courier, the reason she's gonna be on the show is cause guess what? Over there at The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill's joint, they got a brand new scoop. The drone papers. The Intercept has obtained a cache of secret documents detailing the inner workings of the U.S. military's assassination program in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. The documents, provided by a whistleblower, offer an unprecedented glimpse into Obama's drone wars. Oh, very good. So, Cora Courier has one part of this investigative story. Peter Mass, who has another piece of it, tweeted out this morning that this is the reason we've been neglecting our families for the last 30 days. the last three months, I think he said. I know there was a three in there somewhere. Yeah, this is why we've been neglecting our friends and our colleagues and our families for the last 3 months, Peter Mass said, because we've been working on this. The drone papers. TheIntercept.com/drone papers. Oh, it's actually, there's a hyphen in there, drone-papers. Anyway, so Cora's part is the kill chain, new details about the secret criteria for drone strikes and how the White House approves targets. So, cool. She's going to be on for talking about that. And then, did you see the news this morning? I know you're not going to be surprised or shocked. And in fact, I would be surprised or shocked if you even thought that the opposite of this could possibly be true. But Obama announced we're staying in Afghanistan. Staying in Afghanistan. I know, you're saying, but gee whiz, Scott, I saw on TV that the war was over at the end of last year. So how can we stay? Wouldn't we have to go back? And of course, the answer is no, you're just being facetious because you know that they never left at the end of last year. Like they said, they were gonna, there's still 10,000 American GIs and Marines there. Or I don't know, Marines, but Army. And maybe Marines. Air power. Obviously the Air Force is there. The CIA and all their mercenaries. And plus another, 3,000 NATO troops of different descriptions, something like that, are in Afghanistan still. And yeah, I mean, you're hearing this live in October of 2015. The gray hairs on the side of my head and in my chin, they prove that this is the future we're talking about here. 14 years into the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, they've still lost. They lost the whole time, really. Not that the Taliban ever had the power to drive them out of the country, but they've certainly been unable to conquer it. In 14 years, the longest war in American history, and fighting against basically civilians with rifles. I mean, I know we've all seen the very impressive footage of the Mujahideen training on the monkey bars, but it's not quite like the advanced Afghan army that's been trained by American Rangers, right? Who turn and flee when they outnumber their enemy by 10 to 1. Well, anyway. So Obama announced, yeah, well, we're not leaving. Remember, this is the guy who, despite some of your willful ignorance on the subject at the time, some, I said, this is a man who promised to expand the Afghan war, who said that the Afghan war was the good war, that the worst thing about the Iraq war was it distracted us from the real war that had to be fought in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And then even though he knew it was a crock, he escalated the war in Afghanistan, which only made matters worse there and really didn't accomplish anything. And he escalated the war in Afghanistan as well, with the full surge of 60,000 soldiers under McChrystal and then Petraeus. Well, first under McChrystal and Petraeus, then Petraeus without McChrystal. And lost. The mission, according to David Petraeus, was to clear, hold, and build all of Afghanistan, to change their entire society, to give them a government in a box full of dispassionate professional technocrats who would make a bunch of white North Americans out of them damn Pashtuns. And they even said, no, we're not going to defeat the Taliban. What, a ragtag band of insurgents? We couldn't possibly defeat them. But what we're going to do is we're going to hurt them so bad that they agree to our terms. By July 2011, they're going to come begging us to negotiate. But then, of course, the only negotiating they did was with an imposter who was just taking their money and pretending to be a front man, a negotiator for the Taliban. He was just some crank, and they were such idiots that that was the entire, or at least the major extent of their attempted negotiation, was with an imposter. They completely blew it, and the Taliban never was negotiating, because, of course, they're just waiting. The long war. Who do you think can hold out longer in the long war on the other side of the planet Earth from here? They think they can. And despite Obama's extension of the war today, which, look, he signed a contract promising to stay till 2024 back in 2010. So, no surprise, but I doubt their calculation has changed. Just keep waiting. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Yeah, Obama. Anyway, I don't want to talk too much about Afghanistan because it's going to be the Margulies interview will be about it and everything, but I saw Obama saying, oh, yeah, no, it's in the national security interest of the United States of America. We've got to stay because we will not let Afghanistan again become a safe haven from which terrorists can attack the United States of America. Are you kidding me? Would somebody show this idiot a globe? They speak as though, you know, like the Israelis talk about the West Bank. Oh, we can't give up the West Bank, or then our enemies will use it to launch attacks down upon us or something. Well, that's not plausible, but at least the West Bank is adjacent to Israel. You know, they kind of have that argument as, you know, that fact as part of their kernel of truth and their line of crap. But what's so special about Afghanistan that gives it unique access to the United States of America? That's why Bill Clinton encouraged Sudan and didn't do anything, encouraged Sudan to kick Osama out and send him to Afghanistan. Should have probably had him killed right then. But instead they said, well, what harm can he do from exile on the Durand Line? In no man's land, on the ass end of planet Earth from here. There was nothing about Afghanistan that gave the 9/11 hijackers access to the United States. What was special about them was they were graduate students living in Germany. And so when they went to Afghanistan, they were recruited because, hey, you have Western passports. Cool. And then they spent about a year, and some of them even more than that, in the country, at flight schools, talking on the telephone, spending money electronically on cards. As James Bamford writes in the book The Shadow Factory, some of their very last planning meetings took place at a motel just down the street from National Security Agency headquarters. That some of the phone calls that they made to buy their plane tickets were on payphones at a supermarket on a Saturday that must have been full to the gills with National Security Agency employees and their families shopping on a Saturday afternoon right there in the neighborhood. There's your safe haven, America. You know, with the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA on the case, keeping you nice and snugly safe. No, we got to stay in Afghanistan because Afghanistan, magically somehow, no argument here, just skip argument, just accept Afghanistan gives terrorists unique access to the United States. And I guess if you buy that, then you don't see the problem in overthrowing Saddam, in overthrowing Assad, and basically bringing bin Laden's pathetic little movement of hardly any nobodies back in 2001, 2,000 miles to the west, giving them access to the Mediterranean Sea and increasing their numbers by tens of thousands of people, huh? Well, gee, since Afghanistan already provides them unique access to the United States somehow because of some argument no one ever bothered attempting to even try to make, then I guess it makes no difference whether we give them all of Western Iraq and still maybe all of Syria. At least Eastern Syria. But yeah, for the rest of you though, doesn't that seem like kind of a load of crap? Safe haven for terrorists. I'm buying that. Yeah, meanwhile, the moderate Free Syrian Army is planning suicide attacks against the Russians in Syria. Who's accusing them of that? They are. The statement from FSA Captain Rashid al-Hurani said the plan is to endure the violent aerial bombardment and then to get some people to infiltrate the Syrian military, hoping they can locate the Russians and from there carry out martyrdom operations against them. Not exactly what they... That was how they recruited the 9/11 hijackers. We need you to do a martyrdom operation in America. This is the moderate Free Syrian Army. Sorry, I know I hate it. I sound like a Republican in my own ears when I say it. Just the statement out of context. But it is true. Obama is guilty of high treason. Providing aid and comfort to the enemies of the American people. There is no country on this planet that is a threat to us. There's no country on this planet that even means us harm. Not a single nation state has a government willing to attempt to try to hurt America or its people. Its people. The people who live here. We have only one group of enemies in the world. Those who do what Ayman al-Zawahiri says. That's it. And those are the guys our government is backing. And it's not because Obama's a secret Muslim and is trying to help the terrorists because he loves them so much. It's because, really, he's a secret Israeli. You know, people make such a big deal about his name as Hussein. Well, his name is Barack, too. Their former prime minister and defense minister over there. And this is Israeli policy that says that the Shia enemy is the worst enemy, even though it was the vanguard radical edge of Salafist Sunni Islam. Their members who were the attackers of September 11th. And you're just supposed to, I don't know. What do you do with your cognitive dissonance when you're a good little American citizen and you hear your government say that Al-Qaeda in Syria are the moderates, and that the Free Syrian Army, way more moderate than them, also are suicide bombers. And also, as Patrick Coburn has reported on the show numerous times, endorsed the September 11th attacks against the United States. And also include groups like the Northern Storm Brigade, who brag that they too are veterans of Iraq War II, where they fought with Al-Qaeda in Iraq against the United States, against American soldiers there. These are the moderates. Their leader says, yeah, we're planning suicide attacks on the Russians. Meanwhile, U.S. drops arming unvetted Syrian rebel factions. U.S. weapons drops. Oh, see, yeah, bad English, Horton. U.S. weapons drops arming unvetted Syrian rebel factions. Yeah, got it. Drops being the noun there. Part of the noun. Yeah. Rebels don't need to be vetted. They're just dropping weapons straight to al-Nusra and friends now. Not even funneling them through the FSA. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours, max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. Coming up, Eric Margolies. And then Cora Courier. Yeah, I know. It's really entertaining, isn't it? All right. U.S. sending ground troops and drones to Cameroon to fight Boko Haram. Invoking the War Powers Act. President Obama informed Congress yesterday he is deploying, which the War Powers Act does not in any way give the president the authority to launch a war. It's such a damn lie. You can read it yourself. You don't even need your librarian to help you understand it or anything. Just look at the goddamn thing. If America is attacked, the president has the authority to respond and keep responding for up to 60 days, however long it takes to get Congress together to approve it. That's it. He does not have the authority. Jesus Christ. Just think about when they passed it and how they passed it. They passed it over Nixon's veto. They didn't want another Gulf of Tonkin resolution. They were not saying, oh, here, Mr. President, is a grant of even more authority for you to start wars all by yourself. They were attempting to, with legislation, reinforce the limits in the Constitution, which say that only Congress can declare war. And they said, well, in this day and age of first strike nuclear capabilities and so forth, if we're attacked, the president, of course, can defend us just as long as it takes to get Congress together to make it legal. Anyway, so whatever. What's new? Barack Obama's lying to you and killing people. Invoking the War Powers Act, which doesn't say that he can do this at all. Obama informed Congress today he is deploying 300 ground troops and drones to the West African nation of Cameroon on a mission aimed at helping governments tamp down a, quote, regional Muslim anti-colonial movement. Yes, well, America ever on the side of the colonialists. Am I right? The White House says the deployment is going to be part of a broader regional effort, and that the mission is totally open-ended, with the troops to remain until they are, quote, no longer needed in the country. Though, as usual, they declined to lay out what this situation would look like. In the notification to Congress, Obama suggested, he didn't even give a speech or go on TV and announce, he just sent Congress a letter. In the notification to Congress, Obama suggested fighting Boko Haram would be a big part of this operation, and that the intention is for the troops and drones to conduct intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance operations in the region. So anyway. Well, whatever. There's 52 nations in Africa, and the U.S. has special forces in how many? 27 of them? Actually have an invite to Terse out today. I can't keep track, but Nick Terse keeps track of it all for us. Yeah. Ramzi Baroud has a piece running on antiwar.com today. Of course, it's an intifada. This is what you must know. And he said, hey, you know, this isn't the third intifada. This is the 1600th intifada. And little bitty intifadas all the damn time. The Palestinians, of course, have a right to exist. It's as simple as that. And you know what? Back to the same thing that I always say again. I got this email this morning. Do you get the Mondo Weiss email in the morning? I suggest that you do that. But I think this is really important here, man. Let me find the right one. No context is the title of the article. Perfect.
It's by Patrick Connors. No context. In a month of New York Times coverage, Israeli military occupation goes nearly unmentioned. You see? Again. This is why. And didn't you learn this when you were a little kid? Because you saw it on Matlock, and so you asked your mom or your dad, what's all that about? The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That's the oath in court. And what's that whole truth thing about? Because half-truths can be just as bad or worse than an outright lie. Leaving out pertinent information. Truncating the antecedents. Is lying. And so, of course, sometimes in the New York Times, they just outright lie right to your face and laugh at you, which is fun. But much more often, it's this kind of thing. Reads Mondo Weiss today. Today's New York Times has a front-page article by Jody Ruderin on recent Palestinian attacks on Israelis, titled Leaderless Palestinian Youth, Inspired by Social Media, Drive Rise in Violence in Israel. That quotes three Israeli experts and ascribes the attacks to social media. The article refers to the occupied West Bank once in passing, but has nothing to say about the long history of Palestinian resistance to occupation and colonization. That omission is a pattern in the New York Times coverage of the conflict. So that's Mondo Weiss. And then Patrick Connors has this analysis of the previous 27 articles from the last month in the New York Times. In the last 27 articles by Jody Ruderin, Isabel Kirshner, and Dia Hadid, dating back to September 10th, and all the links are below, there is almost no mention of Israeli military occupation or of expanding Israeli control and settlements throughout the West Bank and East Jerusalem, of Israel's wall and checkpoints isolating East Jerusalem, or of increasing poverty in East Jerusalem. These 27 articles include two on Gaza that do not mention poverty in Gaza, and two on Netanyahu and Abbas's speeches at the UN. I did not include Jody's single article on the Golan Heights. I bolded all, this is, the guy's name again is Patrick Connors, is who I'm reading here, speaking first person annoyingly. I bolded all mentions of occupation, occupied, or occupying, and pasted them below with the article links. There were total 27 mentions of occupied or occupation in the 27 articles, and 14 of those 27 are simply the NYT stock phrase, Occupied West Bank, with no mention of even who is doing the occupying. The Times does not call East Jerusalem occupied. Does not. And only once quotes anyone, Mahmoud Abbas, saying that East Jerusalem is occupied. The other 12 uses of occupied or occupation are from very brief quotes of Palestinians. I also copied and pasted mentions of the causes of the tension and violence. Many of the 27 articles have focused or touched on tensions in East Jerusalem, yet only one article provides even a minimal account of context to Israel's systematic takeover of East Jerusalem. A September 10th article, period, end of the sentence, bad punctuation there. In the rest, the Times continually repeats stock phrases along lines that would imply that there is simply a religious conflict over control of the Haram al-Sharif. Like this one. The latest violence comes after weeks of escalating tensions and confrontations around the contested old city compound that houses Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. Blah, 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 blah. Oh, you know how them religious people are, always just fighting over their different religions and things. Truth is somewhere in between. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Let's stop and laugh at Rand Paul for a minute. Ha ha. What a loser. Did you see the footage, man? They did a thing. You know, who needs principle? Who needs honesty? Who needs truth? Who needs anything of value? What we all need is the next new gimmick. Right? Give us another gimmick, Rand. What's Rand's next gimmick going to be, everyone? Aren't you on the edge of your seat just waiting to be won over by his next gimmick? Well, this time his gimmick was a live feed of him all day long. Which, of course, didn't work and cut out the whole time. It was a joke. I didn't watch it, but I read about it. And part of the footage of that is, oh, let's take some questions from Google. And he's like on this, out on some lonely highway or something. It's just the perfect background. And then the top Google question that he got, apparently, was, are you still running for president? And so what does he do? Because he's Rand Paul. He starts whining. Of course I'm running for president. I wouldn't be doing this stupid live stream gimmick stupid thing if I wasn't running for president, would I? And, you know, the thing is, there's no one in America who deserves to be humiliated like Rand Paul is being humiliated, like Rand Paul. He is the betrayer of all things decent. And he's going down in exactly the flames he deserves. And I'm proud of libertarians, man. I'm happy that everybody hates him. Hardly anybody supports him at all. And the ones who do, they just ain't actually read about what he's about. And then when they find out, they go, oh, jeez. I guess I just kind of assumed he was Ron Paul's son. How bad could he be? But I guess you got a point. And he's just got that whole, well, this gimmick isn't working out today, guys, kind of douchebag crybaby attitude that it's just perfect. I keep trying gimmick after gimmick, guys, and I'm having a hard time. Isn't that what that's what Donald Trump said? You're having a hard time tonight. You got to admit it. Donald Trump, when he picks an insult, he picks just the right insult, you know? Poor little crybaby Rand. Tattletale Rand. And because he's betrayed his father, and because he's betrayed libertarianism, and because he's betrayed everybody who ever supported him because they assumed that, hey, he's Ron Paul's son, how bad could he be? And because he does nothing but flop around pandering before every group that still doesn't like him anyway, all the people who really wanted to believe in him have all given up, have all hopped off that bandwagon a long time ago. In fact, the thing I hear most often is, are you still talking about that? Or who even cares about that? Rand Paul, I'll tell you what, he did this one thing, whether it was stabbing his father in the back for a failed, attempted, never had a chance at. How did he really convince himself otherwise? A chance at the losing Paul Ryan spot on the Romney ticket in 2012. Good call, Rand. Or whether it was, you know, saying we should stay in Afghanistan, or whether we should be arming the Kurds and promising them their own new sovereign nation, or being horrible on the Iran deal, on Israel-Palestine, whatever it is. His VAT tax. Oh, he don't want to get rid of the IRS and the income tax. He wants to make a VAT. Oh, to be very fair. Yeah, no, we don't need to repeal the 16th Amendment. We'll just We'll just have more and all different kinds of taxes all the time. It'll be awesome. Anyway, whatever it was, people gave up a long time ago on him. And so now he's so frustrated, and it's got to be that he knows why. He knows why. Moving to the right, becoming more and more and more mainstream, which he always really was a conservative Republican anyway. He never really was as good as his dad by a long shot, you know. But becoming more and more and more horrible was supposed to keep all of us on board, but was going to win over all the rest of the conservative movement too. And the whole Tea Party and everything. Oh no, the right didn't need leading to a more libertarian direction. Just libertarians and the right all needed leading to support Rand. And all he had to do was just flop around and pander to all sides at all times, flip-flop and change his mind and contradict himself all the time in order to please whoever he's talking to at any given moment. And then we'll all support him and make him our dear leader of the whole world empire. That was what he thought. And this is what happened instead. The headline right now at the Daily Caller says, Rand Paul campaign releases memo explaining why he won't drop out of the race. Oh, yeah, you guys just don't understand, man. Just wait until we get to Iowa because, you know, we're certain that all the college kids are going to vote for him. That's all they say. That's all they say. Oh, yeah, and in New Hampshire, we're very well positioned. We've got a very strong ground force. Being buried by even Jeb Bush. And think about Jeb Bush, right? Like, if you and me were Republicans, I could have given the exact speech I just gave about Rand, about Jeb. What a loser. This guy was supposed to be our guy, right? But Jeb is still completely trouncing Rand in all the polls. Rand won over exactly nobody. And here's what's fun about this. His father is such the perfect example in every way of how it could have been done instead. And the only failure about Ron Paul's campaigns were the staff who wouldn't follow his lead, who were running a Rand Paul-like campaign, even though every time Ron Paul was given the microphone, he sounded exactly like himself. It was Ron that won people over. His campaign actually just turned people off. They ran him as the one true veteran and all this kind of thing. But what did actual Ron run as? As libertarian as hell. Hi, I'm Ron Paul, and I'm as libertarian as hell. I don't want to do a bunch of stuff. I want to make the government stop doing a bunch of stuff. And what did Ron Paul do? With his consistent libertarian position, he had something for everybody. And he wasn't pandering. He was never pandering. But something that he said was enough to appeal to the very best of the left and the best of the right and the best of the youth who hadn't really formed their political identity yet and said, hey, here's a guy telling me I ain't got to be a commie to be anti-war. Cool. No offense to you commies, but that's important to most people that, you know. Because, you know, it's all social psychology, man. That's what it is. And so Ron said, no, you don't have to be Susan Sarandon or Jane Fonda to be an anti-war guy. I'm an anti-war guy. And all that kind of thing. And he appealed to all different kinds of people. All different kinds. In fact, before he ever ran for president, all the different kinds of people across America who loved Ron had every different description you could have thought of. You know, from the punk rockers to the crusty old conservatives and whoever else in between. He's got something for everybody. What's Rand Paul's strategy? Pander and flip-flop and desperately, dishonestly try to please all the different factions with one line of crap or another. And what did it get him? Nothing. As the former blogger and now Twitterer Bill Mond put it, yeah, Rand Paul, he's selling out, but nobody's buying. And in fact, he was linking to another article in the Daily Caller where they had an in-depth investigation with all of Rand's staff. And they were talking about, yeah, we're trying to figure out how to sell out. Who should we sell out to more and worse, the fiscal conservatives or the born-again Christians? And then they talked to the fiscal conservatives and the born-again Christians. And they were like, Rand Paul? We have no interest in him. He can pander to us all he wants. We already have our guys. And they're like, yeah, his strategy is to be everybody's second choice. Oh, yeah, that's working out really well, man. It's working exactly as well as it should work. And I'm going to laugh my ass off if he loses his Senate seat, too. Let Ron Paul have the spotlight back. Go back to getting Donald Trump to pay for charity eye surgery while you consistently smear the guy. I mean, he's an evil fascist, but still, he's paying for your charity. Turn around and stab him in the back. Anyway, go do eyes and leave the politics to Dad. You suck, Rand. You blew it. You no good. Go home. Stay home. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com.
Aw, hell. See, man, that's the problem with Skype. It sounds better most of the time if it works. But, you know, if somebody's symbol is white in the middle or yellow or something, then you can't talk to them. Ain't no talking happening. Cannot talk. Cannot receive. Try to type a text message to him. That ain't going either. Ah, well. The good thing about Skype is if Eric Margulies turns on his Skype in the middle of this segment, I can just hit the button and I won't have to stop and make the phone call. So, you know, there's that, I guess, you know. I feel like things like that. Yeah, well. Anyway. If that didn't work, then that's all right, because... I'll just talk with Eric tomorrow or something. Let's see. I had an Iran story here. Where'd it go? Top of the page. Iran ratifies nuclear deal after okay by Guardian Council. How many different ratifications does this thing need? Well, I guess that's enough of them finally. So, I guess... they're still supposed to have the so-called possible military dimensions file of BS all straightened out by the middle of December. And then the nuclear deal gets implemented in January, so that's good. I did read a story. I mean, I don't know what's really going on in the background. But, Netanyahu has decided to tone it down for now and finally accept that the nuclear deal is the nuclear deal and that they can't stop that. But, anyway, I don't know. Wouldn't it be nice if the level of propaganda about Iran's nuclear, regime, their nuclear program, if it stayed at these levels from now on, that's tolerable, right? Yeah, a little bit of BS here and there, but pretty much nobody's listening. Okay, cool. I think I could tolerate that level of false accusations meant to draw us into war. And they're all so easy to debunk, you could all do it by heart now. All right. Oh, yeah. This is fun.
This is something I've been meaning to get to and haven't enough. Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Foreign Minister, Russia supporting Iraq in fight against the Islamic State. I guess they kind of have been, right? Sending planes and stuff like that. Iraq confirms new intel sharing program used for recent strikes. Speaking today, that'd be yesterday, at a conference in Finland, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov confirmed his nation is supporting Iraq's central government and the Kurdistan regional government in their fight against the Islamic State, saying all involvement is being done at the request of the Iraqis. Iraqi officials confirmed this, with Defense Committee head Hakim Zamili reporting that the newly established Baghdad Information Center was the source of intelligence used in recent airstrikes against the Islamic State, including one Iraq says hit numerous IS leaders. The information center was created, and apparently that's true, by the way, because that guy Joel Wing, who does musings on Iraq, he was saying, yeah, you know, they said three times that they've killed this guy before, but then, oh, the Islamic State confirmed it this time, that he really was killed. So it was in that, I think that's the same strike on the leadership. And he was saying it was a pretty important guy up at the top. I don't know what difference it would make, but anyway. The Information Center was created as a joint clearinghouse of anti-ISIS or ISIS intelligence, with Russia, Iraq, Iran, and Syria all participating. The U.S. was also invited to take part and not only declined, but also cut back bilateral intelligence sharing with Iraq in response. I know I'm a broken record. I was thinking about this the other day, man. My show must be getting really boring. Yeah, Scott Horton, all he does is explain every day how America's government is on the side of the American people's enemies. And not in the BS way where, like, oh, boo-hoo, Obama's supporting Iran or something. He's not, really. And Iran isn't our enemy. Al-Qaeda's our enemy. And just think about this, man. I mean, in the Islamic State, they don't declare their loyalty to Zawahiri. They do declare their loyalty to bin Laden, but bin Laden's dead, so the Islamic State had never really attacked the United States. It's Al-Qaeda more than anything, including the al-Nusra Front in Syria, who are the American people's enemies. But, you know, certainly, I guess the Islamic State does have motive to attack the United States and try to draw us into war over there, but they haven't really yet. They hit a couple of targets in Europe. All the ISIS so-called plots here were all FBI agents pretending to be ISIS, so that doesn't count. You know, just tricking some idiot. But, you know, anyway. Here you have, it's so obvious, right? The so-called Crescent. The Shiite side is Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, backed by Russia, and including Iraq, America's ally, Shiistan, in Iraq. They're in it with those guys. And America is on the side of the Saudis and their allies, the Turks, the Israelis, the Qataris, and Al-Qaeda in this sectarian war. That's sort of kind of true that America is on the Shiite side in Iraq. They have been bombing the Islamic State somewhat and providing support to the Shiite factions, but the battle lines are getting, you know, less foggy and more clear that, hey, guess what? Bush fought that whole Iraq war for a bunch of people who meant it when they told him to now piss off. Thanks for doing our dirty work for us. Now beat it. We don't need you. We got Iran and Russia. Quote unquote, the Bada Brigade. Quote unquote, the Dawa Party. Get the hell out. And so, oh yeah, Iraq's our ally. Iraq's our ally. Yeah, well, they'll keep accepting your money and guns. But anyway, assuming that you were the empire, never mind libertarianism, never mind non-interventionism, never mind moral reservations about slaughtering people or anything like that. But if you were just an American imperialist Wouldn't it make sense to back the Shiites against the Islamic State? Hey, then we don't even have to fight. Let them do it. The Russians want to do our dirty work for us? Fine. Wouldn't that at least make sense? As highly murderous and horrible and ultimately counterproductive and everything else it would be, but all those, you know, actual objections aside, I'm saying, presuming the prerogatives of the empire, wouldn't you think that they would want to crush the Baghdadi government to very quickly explain that that's no caliphate, that was no caliphate, that thing that no longer exists, that was nothing but a small militia with big pretensions, and now they're gone? Wouldn't you think that that would be what the empire would want to accomplish here? But nope, still, a year and a half after backing Al-Qaeda in Syria blew up to such proportion that, you know, they sacked Mosul, first Fallujah, then Mosul, very quickly after that, Ramadi, took over all of Iraqi Sunnistan. A year and a half later, America's still on the side of the bin Ladenites. Mostly because Israel, of course, hates the Iranians and their allies more. And, of course, it's just in the interests of the state and their cronies to keep the conflict going. For money and power and promotions and ribbons. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys. I'm me. It's my show, Scott Horton's show. I got Eric Margolies on the line. Hey, Eric, how are you, man?
I'm fine, Scott. Just writing about Turkey at this moment. Another big disaster area.
Yeah, another compared to what? Oh, yeah, that list.
Afghanistan, Iraq.
Palestine.
Syria, you name it.
Man. All right, well, so listen, everybody. The reason that I have you listen to Eric all the time is because, yeah, he knows what he's talking about. He's covered 14 wars, wrote a couple of books about it, War at the Top of the World, American Raj, that is empire, liberation or domination, and really is expert on all these places, been to all these places, and I almost sort of kind of don't know where to begin, but let's talk about Afghanistan here, Eric. Dear Leader says... The troops that didn't leave at the end of last year, like in the deal, they're staying for at least another few years. Of course, this is in reaction to the fall of Kunduz. And there's a great article by Tom Englehart, in fact, today, where he's quoting DIA guys or whatever, CENTCOM guys from a couple of months ago saying, oh, yeah, you know, the Taliban, they've been doing little hit-and-run attacks around Kunduz for a little while here, but we're pretty sure that that's never going to amount to anything and that Kunduz is in no danger of actually being attacked itself or anything like that. It was just a couple of months ago. Now the whole thing's fallen and they've decided, I don't know if they were ever leaving or not, but now at least they're admitting that they never were. But so then what do you think is going to happen?
I think what's going to happen is that American troops will remain like a British imperial garrison during the 19th century, and they'll be there long enough to hold some major cities and the American air bases. Same thing that the British Empire did in Iraq. And they'll keep their puppet government, Ashraf Ghani, in power and pretend everything is good. And but really, America also has 35,000 mercenary troops in Afghanistan, and these guys will remain and work America's will.
Mm. Well, now, so, but here's the problem with the mercs and even the so-called professional army. I don't know if you're trying to distinguish there between the Afghan army and mercs. That's pretty much all they are. They're only fight for a paycheck, so when the Taliban come, they run. Because they're not there to fight for God and country and this and that. They're there fighting for to try to get a little bit ahead before they have to quit.
That's right. And many of them are from ethnic minorities, like Tajiks and Uzbeks, with whom the Americans have allied themselves, immediately making them enemies of the majority Pashtuns. But the American-paid mercenaries are much more reliable. There's the scum of the gutter from all over the world. They're professional gunmen. They're not as likely to run away as the useless Afghan army.
Mm. So in other words, you're saying basically they're going to keep enough power to keep the Taliban out of Kabul. They're going to have enough American and allied mercenary and NATO and whatever power to keep the Taliban from taking the capital city. Maybe take back Kunduz?
Well, Scott, yes. I think the Taliban has pulled out of Kunduz for the very good reason that the U.S. Air Force is blasting the hell out of it.
Oh, they already have retreated then.
Yeah, and as we saw in last week's horrifying attack on the Médecins Sans Frontières hospital in Kunduz by an American C-130 gunship, it's American air power that is decisive in Afghanistan. If the U.S. Air Force was not on call 24/7 in the skies over Afghanistan, America would be run out. Its troops would be cut off, and they'd have to flee for their lives, just like the British did three or four times in the 19th century. All thanks to the Air Force that we keep our imperial banner flying in the Hindu Kush, however, it costs a mint.
Yeah. Well, and even then, I mean, obviously they're keeping the Taliban from rolling into Kabul the way ISIS rolled into Mosul kind of thing in a big convoy, but they can pretty much just sneak their guys in there a few at a time and maybe do some kind of Tet Offensive type of thing from the inside. I mean, they've only got, a couple of 10,000 guys, including the mercs and all of that. How many did the Taliban have? They're at least from there. They got to be able to field more than the Americans at this point, no?
Oh, yes, they do, but it's not numbers of infantry, volunteer infantry that will decide the war. You know, I was there in Afghanistan when the Najibullah regime, another puppet regime that was backed by the Soviets, was left to confront its enemies with the Mujahideen, who were our freedom fighters, as President Reagan called them, and only turned into terrorists afterwards. And what became very clear is that any Afghan with even a tiny IQ had made secret deals with the opposition, knowing that the Soviet puppet regime would not survive. Everybody called up their cousin Abdul, who was in the Taliban, and made deals. So that a lot of things that happened were arranged in advance. And the Afghans are, you know, have been at war forever. They've learned to prepare and to plan for these kind of changes.
Yeah. All right. Now, so, hey, let me ask you real quick about what's going on in, especially in East Jerusalem, but in Palestine, what you make of it. Do you think there's a major change coming to the status of the Al-Aqsa Mosque there?
I hope not, but it is possible because Israel's right wing, far right wing, which are very dominant, has made this a major issue and wants to implant Jewish control or increase it over the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the second holiest site in Islam. Now, I find feuding and fighting over religious things to be exceptionally distasteful and low IQ, but both sides are at it, hammer and tongs, and the Israeli security forces are shooting down Palestinians in the street. They said they had a knife for their attackers, but the situation is growing much more dangerous. But unfortunately, the only way Palestinians can fight is that stabbings, rock throwings, and having large numbers of their people killed so that it stays in world headlines.
Yeah. And now, so do you think that the Palestinians have good reason to fear that the Israelis are going to just take it over and kick them out and start rebuilding the Third Temple or some crazy thing?
I don't think that's going to happen, at least not now. But I think the Israelis will use salami tactics to expand their control over Al-Aqsa and to deny access to more and more Palestinians so that they can then begin some sort of Temple Mount renovation. But this is going to take a while, and it's going to be a bloody business.
All right. Well, I guess I'll try to have you back either tomorrow or Monday or as soon as I can about your Turkey article as soon as it comes out, because there's a lot to learn about that place that I got to do here, and I think a lot of the audience is with me on that. So very much looking forward to talking with you about that thing as soon as it comes out.
It's a deal, Scott.
All right. Good deal. Thanks very much, Eric. That is the great Eric Margulies, everybody. EricMargulies.com. Spell it like Margolis. EricMargulies.com, and you can find him at LouRockwell.com all the time, too. We'll be right back in just a sec. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, all, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, you guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. And they got a big one at The Intercept, brand new out today, TheIntercept.com. The drone papers. The Intercept has obtained a cache of secret documents detailing the inner workings of the U.S. military's assassination program in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. The documents, provided by a whistleblower, offer an unprecedented glimpse into Obama's drone wars. And one of the stories, at least here, I haven't had time to dig through it all yet, is by Cora Currier, our old friend from ProPublica. And now here she is at The Intercept. Her piece is called The Kill Chain. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Cora?
Hi, Scott. Thanks so much for having me.
Very happy to have you back on the show. Good piece of work here.
Thank you.
Your job is basically parsing through the PowerPoints, huh, and figuring out exactly what's the chain of command on the intelligence and on the permission to wage the actual strikes. Is that correct?
Yeah, we actually had, I actually do have a second story in there. There's one called Firing Blind, which is about the intelligence that goes into
the strikes.
Oh, I see.
Yes, yes, there it is.
Yeah. But we've got, yeah, basically we had both stories come from the same PowerPoint, which was a internal Pentagon study of operations in Yemen and Somalia between 2011 and 2013. And it's a pretty critical assessment internally of the resources and, you know, just some of the inherent limitations of the drone campaign in these countries.
Okay, well, give us some examples of those where you're saying this is sort of like a little bit of a self-criticism exercise inside the Pentagon, going back over what they've been doing. So what are the flaws that they point out?
Well, it's a self-criticism exercise in which they hope to will end up with getting them more resources. So the first thing that they point to is they say we don't have enough equipment. We don't have enough drones. We're flying, we're having to fly manned planes. One of the revelations was that there's a huge number of sorties by manned planes over Yemen, which I think is not something people appreciate when we talk about the drone program generally. So they were saying, give us more drones, give us better drones, because capacities that they had at that point to use high-definition video to collect cell phone communications via drone, like to flying over targets and sucking up their communications. They were saying that those weren't adequate and that they weren't they didn't have the capabilities that they needed to build a full intelligence picture on the ground in Yemen or Somalia. And of course, that's disturbing because they were still killing hundreds of people over the during those years, while they were admitting that they didn't have, you know, a lot of confidence in the intelligence that they were and the amount of intelligence and the type of intelligence that they were able to get. Mm-hmm.
And well, and of course, that's kind of self-serving, but it sounds like, you know, there's at least, you know, truth in their admissions, even though, of course, as you're saying, they're spending it for better budget, better equipment, et cetera, like that. But still important lessons in there.
Another of the interesting takeaways that they and sort of disturbing takeaways from the study is that they said that a sort of blunt admission that there are very few captures. Captures are basically non-existent, and that the there's this military doctrine called find, fix, finish, which means you're looking for a target, you identify them, and then you finish them, right? Which means kill or capture them. And because there's virtually no capture happening in Yemen, very rarely in Somalia, that means that you're just killing people. And when you're just killing people, you don't get any intelligence from them. Now, of course, we saw the very, very dark side of what happens when you capture and interrogate people during the Bush years. But these documents are also a really frank assessment of some of the ramifications when you have no interrogation and no captures and you're just killing people and not generating any new intelligence on the ground. And that was one of the main things in this brief, was the Pentagon advocating for more captures, either by U.S. advanced special operations forces or by partners. And of course, again, partner governments brings up a whole host of issues about human rights concerns and abuses.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, they had said before that, I guess in the New York Times Terror Tuesday piece from a few years back there, that, well, they part of the decision making about whether to kill them with a drone or not was whether it was feasible for them to be captured. And it seemed like they were trying to play down how easy it might be to actually arrest somebody in Yemen, when really there was reason to think that, sure, you could. And, of course, we're talking about back before the whole war broke out and all of that there, that at least in the under the Saleh government, there were a lot of these that probably could have been arrests. But that at least was, I believe, what they had said before was, you know, part of the requirement that had to be fulfilled was that we, you know, we really don't have the ability to ask the partner government to try to arrest them or to give us permission to send in people to grab them ourselves. But I wondered, it always kind of seems suspicious that, you know, maybe that was just lip service and what they really meant was they just drone strike as many as they can because they don't really want to capture them and then be stuck with the question of what to do with them.
Yeah, it's definitely, because, as I said, you know, we have the horrific example of detention during the Bush years. And certainly, you know, Obama, I think, genuinely did not want to keep bringing people into Guantanamo, keep holding people in prisons elsewhere. And it did present this very thorny question for them. And I think it became easier just to kill. And clearly in Yemen, you had Saleh, you had Hadi, who, you know, the U.S. felt they could work with. Somalia now, I think, is kind of an interesting example because, you know, the government there is still not the strongest, but there is a, you know, semblance of a government, and there's the African Union forces there. And there's more and more reporting on U.S. special operations working in Somalia. And they've talked publicly, special operations commanders, about using Somalia as this example where they're going to work alongside local forces. So, you know, the military is clearly pushing for this, what they call small footprint approach to war. But they also want to complement it with drones. You know, they basically want all the options. You know, what these papers show is that when you're just doing drone strikes, you're missing a huge part of the picture. But, you know, the options that they want also in terms of a larger U.S. presence are super thorny.
Yeah. Well, and it means that, again, their intelligence ends up being just cell phone data or some vague kind of intercept and an interpretation. And, and, you know, very, very thin reeds to hang death sentences on, but then they go ahead anyway.
Right. One of the revelations in the documents is that the U.S. was relying on SIGINT, or signals intelligence, as you just said, intelligence from phones and other electronic communications, for more than half of their target development in Yemen and Somalia. And but the documents also say very bluntly that this is an inferior form of intelligence, that it's not as timely, and that they need more human intelligence.
Yeah. You know, when the Saudis bombed the wedding with, of course, American help in Yemen just a couple of weeks ago, I tweeted that out, and a veteran who follows me on Twitter responded, "Hey, same as it ever was. I remember one time we killed this guy and his wife right after their wedding. I think he said outside of Ramadi. And the poor bastard just had borrowed the wrong uncle's truck and cell phone. And, you know, I'll never forget the look on her face as we blew her away, you know, kind of thing." You know, that's pretty shoddy intelligence, you know, which cell phone is coming from which truck. But, you know, I guess if you're talking about the CIA and the military in another country, I guess if you're talking about American cops, that might be good enough, too, if they had the drones coming soon. But, yeah, anyway, can you stay with me for one more segment here, Cora?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. All right, y'all, TheIntercept.com, huge scoop, multi-part series going on here thing. The drone papers, TheIntercept.com. We'll be right back with Cora Currier in just a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, all, Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Wrapping up for the day. Talking with Cora Currier from The Intercept. TheIntercept.com. They have a huge new multi-part special series based on a whole bunch of top secret documents. The drone papers. All about the drone wars in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. And obviously I've had a chance to read, I read one of yours, one of the two that you wrote here, Cora, and none of the others. But I wonder about what all might be in there. Like, for example, I don't suppose that they have any very stunning admissions about why they killed Anwar al-Awlaki's son, by any chance, do they?
No, actually, one of the sort of fascinating omissions, on very telling omissions about these in the documents, is that there's almost no discussion of civilian casualties. They talk about you know, the need to avoid civilian casualties as kind of a you know, a limiting factor on drone strikes. They definitely mention that the rules of engagement have to call for low civilian casualties. But at least as far as the Yemen and Somalia documents go, there's very little discussion of civilian casualties. And this is actually the time period when Abdulrahman was killed. So it's interesting. And there was another, you know, very well-documented strike in the fall of 2012 that killed a number of civilians, including a pregnant woman. And none of that's in these documents. This is, again, the internal military's positioning this campaign as being all about high-value targets, all about senior operational people. It actually gives the numbers of people that were on the kill list at a given time. In June 2012, there were 16 targets authorized in Yemen, and in Somalia there were 4. And during that year, 2012, I mean, of course, there could have been turnover on that list, but during that full year, 2012, you know, there were dozens of strikes killing dozens of people, ostensibly all in pursuit of those same four people, of those 20 people.
Here's another thing I wonder if whether it's in there is, I mean, you say that they kind of mentioned that, yeah, that could be problematic, you know, something kind of thing. But I wonder to what degree they explore that at all, because I'm reminded of the Meet the Press episode where David Gregory asked Leon Panetta, and I was kind of surprised he asked him this on Meet the Press, actually, but he said, you know, we're hearing a lot of reports coming out of Yemen saying that people are joining up Al-Qaeda because we're bombing them with these drones. And that's, you know, helping their recruitment. So, you know, I wonder, do you have a good way to count whether we're making more enemies than we're actually killing here? And Panetta basically conceded and said, well, yeah, it's true. But these are the tools we have, and so these are the tools we're going to continue to use. What are you going to do? Have me not use drones to kill these guys, Dave Gregory? And Dave Gregory's like, geez, I don't know. I guess you got to just keep doing it anyway. And then that was it. And it seems like, you know, close enough for government work, right? Sounds like their logic. But I wonder whether they address that in these documents that, you know, we actually have a lot more targets than we did before. And we wonder whether maybe it's the Hellfire missiles that are multiplying these guys.
That doesn't come up in the Pentagon study on Yemen and Somalia. Again, they're like, you know, they talk a lot about the technical problems that they have, the resource issues that they have. And they're sort of explaining why they're not, their operations aren't as fast as in Afghanistan. And that's one of the like sort of striking things about the study is that it's constantly kind of comparing operations in Somalia and Yemen to Afghanistan. And you're like, well, okay, but we have, you know, a full on war in Afghanistan. We have thousands and thousands of troops. And is that really what you're calling for in a place like Yemen? And that was something that we heard, from some of the military sources that we talked to on this. We talked to General Michael Flynn, who was very influential in counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan. And he has been very critical of drone strikes, calling it kind of a, you know, you saying you get one guy, then there's all this blowback, and what does it even matter that we got that one guy? But the implicit alternative that he's offering is a hugely ramped up military presence in a la Afghanistan. And clearly that in Yemen or Somalia is not what we need either. So, you know, there's sort of a subtext of that, but it's not explicitly addressed. We do have papers in this series. There's a fantastic story by my colleague Ryan Devereaux called Manhunting in the Hindu Kush. And that gets into quite some detail on Afghan campaigns and how some of these issues played out there. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now what did you learn that's new and important about the chain of command for, you know, from Obama, his top advisors on the ordering of the strikes and what kind of actual responsibility he's taken himself?
Yeah, so there's an interesting slide in here that shows the chain of command for authorizing a strike. And they describe it as a two-step process. They say that there's the first step is authorization. So they're sort of developing a target. It passes up through the ranks of the military to the Secretary of Defense. Then it passes to a council of advisors known as the National Security Principles Committee. And actually what we know from other reporting is that it's actually the principals are all basically sort of cabinet heads, all the top White House advisors, and then beneath them, their deputies, their second in commands. And it was those committees that would do a lot of the agonizing over these targets and sort of debating them and seeing which were legal. And then they would present, during the time covered by the study, it was John Brennan, who was super influential on these decisions. He would bring the targets to the White House to the president for all the final authorization. And then the second step they call in the sort of jargon of the slide is authorizing to actioning. And that's actually giving the go-ahead for an actual strike. And according to these documents, the president does not sign off on individual strikes. Those require the military command, chain of command, the input from the ambassador and the CIA station chief in the country where the strike's going to take place, and supposedly the host nation, so, you know, the government of Yemen or Somalia, as the case may be.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I don't know. I mean, is there anything that's really that's different than what we knew before about that, or it's just detail, or is there something surprising in there about the chain of command in any way? Anything really notable about it?
I mean, the details is, it's just remarkable that this, you know, there's been all of this kind of off the record descriptions of this process. There's been, I mean, when I was researching this article, I read just about every book that's come out about the drone war in the past couple of years, all the insider accounts, and there's volumes and volumes of off the record officials talking about this process and who's in the room when. And it's just unbelievable that this stuff is classified, like what the, that the sort of bureaucratic process for who makes these decisions needs to be kept like some major secret. So it's just kind of stark to see it on paper in front of you. And this issue of, you know, sort of who's making the call on actual individual strikes, I think is relevant in terms of, you know, sort of how commonplace they are and how seriously the White House takes them. You know, we've heard that since 2013, since the study came out, the White House sort of tightened control over individual strikes even and wanted the Pentagon to get permission for individual strikes.
Mm. And then now, so can you tell us a little bit about, you mentioned Ryan Devereaux's piece here, Manhunting in the Hindu Kush. That looks like a lot of fun. And then, but what's this one, The Life and Death of Objective Peckham?
So this is another fascinating profile that's in the series. Both the Ryans, Ryan Gallagher, and Ryan Devereaux have done these amazing profiles. And the Objective Peckham is the code name given in these documents for a, Egyptian naturalized British citizen named Bilal el-Berjawi, who was killed in February 2012 by the U.S., soon after the U.K. stripped his citizenship from him. So this has been a huge case in the in England over, you know, sort of the legality of stripping this guy's citizenship. And this story, in addition to the documents that we had, which spell out in minute, like minute to minute, the strike in which he was killed, Ryan also obtained a letter, a deposition, basically, that he gave to his lawyers in London, arguing whether or not he should, you know, arguing the stripping of his citizenship. And so this is a huge amount of new material on a really controversial case involving not just the U.S. government, but also the U.K., and raising a lot of issues about the U.K.'s complicity in the U.S. program.
All right, y'all. Well, that is Cora Currier. She is at The Intercept, TheIntercept.com, the brand new multi-part thingamajig that just came out, The Drone Papers. Thanks very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.